let me give you this counterexample that I promised. So basically what we want to do is we want to consider some input state at time t equals 0 for two systems. So here we have psi is an element of HA and phi is an element of HB. And then we're going to imagine a scenario where we have some unitary during a time interval tau 1 applied to psi at t equals 0 tensor phi at t equals 0, another unitary applied at t2, and this is going to create an output state which I'll call chi at t equals I might do a notation here. So this is tau 1, tau 2. I'll just call it chi prime. Is the output state. And so here, chi prime corresponds to, is an element of the Hilbert space HA tensor HB. And this corresponds to time at time t equals tau 1 plus tau 2. So this is the final state. Okay, and now postulate 3, generalized postulate 3. Generalized postulate 3 asserts we should be able to describe to assign a CP map for the dynamics of system A from time from from t equals tau 1 to tau 1 plus tau 2. I'll just call it an interval over this time interval. Okay, so if we want to have a of course, the way I've formulated postulate 3, you can think about reformulating postulate 3 to accommodate this, but let me just say that the point being there, we want some way of describing the dynamics over the time interval on the reduced Hilbert space. And we're going to find there's no way to do that. So the example is just now what we want to do is we choose u tau 1 equal to u tau 2 equal to u c naught discussed previously. And then we remark immediately we'll remark that u c naught squared, which is equal to u c naught times u c naught, is equal to the identity operation on A, the identity super operator, well, the identity map. So here is a dim HA by dim, the dimension of HA, identity operator. Maybe I don't need to use a scripted I. I guess I can just use a regular I. Oh, sorry, this is wrong. This is on AB. So this is dim H by dim H, where H is equal to H A tensor H B.
Sorry, it's identity on the full Hilbert space.
And so then we're also going to choose psi at time t equals zero. So this is the system Hilbert's, the system state. We're going to choose that to be 0 plus 1 over square root of 2. And now here's the trick. We're going to choose, we're going to consider two choices for the ancilla initial state. Consider two choices of the ancilla state. So we want phi at time t equals zero to be either case one is going to be equal to zero, and case two it's going to be equal to one.
This is terrible notation. Let me.
And this is case one. And where it's going to be equal to one in case two.
Okay, so that's the setup. And then I'll give you the conclusion and then I'll prove it or derive it. So basically then the claim is that at time t equals tau 1, the intermediate state for case 1, we're going to have some state, let's call it chi at time tau 1 is an element of aj tensor ajb. So this is the joint state of the two systems. What's going to happen is that this UC not map is going to entangle the two systems for either input state. So that's the key. So at time, we're going to have chi at tau 1 is going to be equal to, here the zero state, it's going to be equal to 0, 0 plus 1, 1 over square root of 2. And in case 2, chi at t1 is going to equal to 0, 1 plus 1, 0 over square root of 2. So these are two different Bell states, which are maximally entangled states. And for both cases, rho A at time t equals tau 1, which is equal to the reduced state by tracing out system B of chi, I'll just call it chi tau 1. In both cases, this is going to be equal to the identity state on system A. Okay, the fully mixed state. Maybe I won't derive it. But now the final state in both cases, for both cases, chi at time t equals tau 1 plus tau 2, which I defined to be chi prime for ease of notation, over here, chi prime is exactly the input state. For both cases, it's equal to the input state, which is psi t equals zero tensor phi.
Hold on a second. All right, this is fine. I haven't said anything wrong yet. That's good. Okay, so for both cases, we have this. But in case one, and let me just add this, for both cases, rho b at time t equals tau 1, which is equal to the trace over a of the same object. Is equal to identity over B. Okay, so the reduced states for each system, we have some density operator that can, you know, postulate one tells us we should assign a density operator. We can do that. But in case one, phi at t equals tau 1 plus tau 2, which is equal to phi at t equals 0, is equal to 0. And in case 2, phi, the final state phi, which is equal to the initial state, is equal to 1. So what that means is, what that means is there exists no linear map and certainly no completely positive map, which is a special case of a linear map. That can describe the action, that can describe the transformation on HB from time t equals tau 1 to t equals tau 1 plus tau 2. Okay, so that's the conclusion. In fact, remark that we have a one-to-many relation. So if you have some kind of transformation that takes as input some fixed object and produces as output one of two different outputs, one of two different states, that's a one-to-many relation. It's not even called a map. The word map doesn't accommodate that notion of this one-to-many picture. Okay, so in fact, describing the dynamics over system B, for system B alone, which is the theory behind using our generalized formalism, the point of the generalized formalism is we don't want to carry around extra Hilbert space. We just want to describe things in the Hilbert space of the system of interest. So the system of interest is B, and over this time, t equals tau 1 to t equals tau 1 plus tau 2 is a one-to-many relation. Requires okay, this is analogous to the state update rule where you have some fixed input state and then you randomly get different output states depending on the output of the measurement. Here, I'll get your question in a second. Here we have different output states over this time interval depending on what the state was at an earlier time. At a time t equals 0, which is before the transformation we're talking, which is well before the transformation of interest. It's kind of in the prior history of what the system was. Yes?
So in the first board, in the third part, it should really be the dynamics of system B, right?
Yeah, I originally thought it was going to be system A, but it's system B. Where? Yeah, thank you. Okay, so look, but things are fine. So let me just before I say if things are, let me just say that this is an important concept for any of you doing, well, really for anything. There's an important concept of non-Markovianity. So this is an example of non-Markovianity. So non-Markovian, in probability theory, there's a notion of a Markov chain. And generally, the idea of a Markov transformation is that if you're talking about a transformation from some time t1 to t2, what you want is you want the output state to depend only on the input state and on the at time t1 and the map from time t1 to t2. It shouldn't depend on anything else. And then another way to think about it is that the map itself should only depend on the time interval of interest. So if you tell me the time interval I'm describing for my physical process, I shouldn't need any other information about like the prior history of the system. I just need to know only a description, only a local in time description of the system. So that leads to what are called Markovian dynamics. Unitary transformations are Markovian in that there's no requirement to specify anything about the prehistory of the system. Maybe in undergrad physics, you've seen examples of this through hysteresis in electromagnetism. So the hysteresis effect is kind of a non-Markovian effect. The system remembers the state it had prior to the immediate moment in which you're describing the physics. So here we see an example of the dynamics on system B remembering something because that information is encoded in system A, and system A is coupled to system B. So that's why the transformation for system B from time t1 to t2 can be non-Markovian. It's because it's coupled to a system, and there's a memory in system A. System A retains a memory of what the state of system B was at time t equals 0. And in that sense, we see how, in this case, system A plays the role of an environment, which contains memory about system B's state at an earlier time. So that's a very general feature. Right now, that's kind of the frontier of a lot of quantum information and condensed matter physics is very much concerned with the fact that now that we have experimental control that's so precise, we can now start seeing deviations from the usual Markovian assumption. So an intriguing example of this is also atomic decay. So if you think of atomic decay as an exponential process, and the signature of a Markovian type process is an exponential decay. But actually, if you look at atomic decays for timescales that are very, very short on the timescale of like femtoseconds, then you see that the actual decay rate is parabolic. It drops off as 1 minus t squared before becoming a nice exponential. Of course, the short time limit of an exponential, e to the minus lambda t, is 1 minus lambda t if t is small. It turns out if you look for really small t at these actual physical processes like atomic decays, you can see 1 minus t squared effects, which is a kind of Markovian effect. Non-Markovian effect. Was there a question?
There was, but...
Okay.
Put it into words.
Oh, well, maybe after class we can touch on it. So the point is, if we're interested to describe the physics, if we want some fundamental way of describing the physics of dynamical transformations of quantum systems, we can do that via the ideal axioms, but the penalty is you have to keep track of extra Hilbert space. So if we're describing a fundamental system and we're including all the relevant degrees of freedom, then we have a unitary transformation and we have a pure state and the ideal axioms work perfectly fine. It's when we take this modern approach, which is only like a decade or two old, of trying to shoehorn quantum mechanics into this generalized description of density operators, completely positive maps, and POVMs, that we see that that model is a phenomenological model that doesn't always work. And so this is kind of, so I'm just kind of trying to insulate you or inoculate you against this modern approach, because I don't think it's the right approach. And let me give you one more argument for that, which is if I asked you to look at the laws of Newtonian physics or Lagrangian, Hamiltonian physics, classical physics, and I asked you to, you know, write down kind of a general model for the dynamics of a system, and you would write down, like, say, Newton's laws. And then you would get these differential equations, the usual second-order differential equations, and or first-order differential equations in the Hamiltonian picture. And if I said, well, try and drive that, you could probably look at some least action principle and drive those dynamical rules. But now I said, well, wait a minute, but that's not the most general description of what can happen. If I slide a block across the floor, Newton's laws tell me it should keep sliding indefinitely, but it doesn't because of friction. So friction slows the block down and it comes to a stop. And that corresponds to a velocity-dependent frictional force. Now, if we want to come up with a general description of how the block is behaving, and we only want to talk about the degrees of freedom of the block, and we're in this real-world setting of sliding it along a carpet, then we have to include a velocity-dependent force, a frictional force, to correctly model its behavior as a mathematical description of the degrees of freedom of the block. Or we can include the degrees of freedom of the floor, describe the physics of how the block couples to all the little rug particles, which will involve an extremely complicated model, but you could probably do it on a computer, and then you could use Newton's laws without the velocity-dependent force, and you could derive the frictional slowing down effect of the block as a phenomenological effect because of the interactions between the carpet and the block. So the point is, in quantum mechanics, I don't think anyone would say in the classical picture, oh, well, let's take velocity-dependent friction forces to be fundamental because we see them, right? No, it's just that, well, you're just ignoring degrees of freedom. You're seeing them because you're ignoring degrees of freedom. You're looking in a smaller dimensional space than the real dimension of the problem. And so if you're trying to derive classical mechanics from first principles by appealing to symmetry principles and stuff like that, I don't think you should try and derive the velocity-dependent term. I think you should understand that's going to emerge as an approximation when I want to throw away some degrees of freedom in my problem. So that's my final argument against this approach. So basically, completely positive maps are analogous to velocity dependent friction forces and Markovian at that, which is a very special case, friction forces in classical physics. So it's not fundamental. Fundamental. Okay, so that finishes that rant. Do we have any questions about it?
So your philosophy is just to take it with a grain of salt, these completely positive maps.
Exactly. So I'll leave it to you guys to convince your supervisors, because I haven't done such a good job. Okay, so with them, well, I just don't have the time to individually proselytize this point of view. Okay, so so now you've seen essentially the full kind of set of axioms in either picture. So now you kind of have a fundamental understanding of quantum mechanics, and everything else is applications. Okay, so of course there's a lot of non-trivial issues that come up in these applications, a lot of cleverness you have to learn, and so on, And but now we kind of make this segue to kind of applying the postulates and so on. And one more piece, which you can kind of argue is well, we won't argue it. So one more piece is that you need to know as a kind of a useful heuristic is the state update rule under a POVM. So in principle, you can now derive this from the previous considerations we've looked at. But let me derive it for you, because there's some pitfalls. I know I should refer to my notes so I don't go too off script here. That's done. Are there any questions about that? I mean, it's, you're ready to move on? We got exciting stuff to cover, so maybe we'll just keep moving. So the state update rule, basically, you've seen it already. Let me just show you what it looks like for so we imagine we have some POVM, which I'll call it a set. We'll look at the discrete case. And then we know that the probability of seeing outcome nu is equal to the trace of rho against e nu given input state rho. And then the question of what is the output state? Well, of course, this is going to depend on how you do the measurement. So it depends how you do the measurement. But let me give you a canonical scenario. Okay, we use the Nyemark dilation theorem. And von Neumann's indirect measurement. Method. So I'll draw it graphically, and then I'll give you equations. So remember, Nyemark told us that we can always realize it in this way. We choose some Ancilla system. We couple the two, and we perform some projective measurement on the ancilla, and then we get an output state, rho A prime. So in this sense, our measurement, and then we can think of this is somehow, I don't need to give that piece. So then what happens is then we get, if we do a conditional, if we're interested in the output state conditional on observing rho, on observing the pointer, which gives us some value nu, we're going to have that rho, let me drop the subscript A, rho is going to go to rho prime equal to rho nu. Which is equal to a sum over j m nu j rho m nu j over the trace of e nu rho, where we keep this denominator just for normalization, so we're describing a normalized state. So that's the general rule. Be careful, some textbooks forget about this extra sum over j, but it's important. It deals with non-degeneracy cases. And then here we have ek, or sorry, e nu. Sorry, my notes use k, so I'm going to keep saying k. This extra sum over j is something that's sometimes forgotten. So e nu is equal to sum over j m nu comma j dagger m nu comma j. So in other words, there exists a set of different what are called measurement operators associated with a fixed POVM element. Okay, so remark that we can always choose some new set of operators. Let me call them a nu j equal to v a nu j and then of course a dagger nu j is equal to this is m nu j. A dagger would then be equal to m nu j dagger v dagger, and then these produce the same e nu. So then e nu is equal to sum over j a nu j dagger a nu j, which is equal to the sum over j m nu j dagger m nu j. So we have this non-uniqueness to the measurement operators. Now notice I chose the symbol a for an important reason. The measurement operators are just like the Krauss operators. The measurement operators are up to some normalization I'm not going to worry about, which gives a normalized state, which is just a constant, up to normalization, Krauss operators. Okay, so what I mean, remember the Krauss operators were required to sum to identity. A dagger, sum over k, a dagger k, a k is equal to identity to give a completely positive trace preserving map. The point is, this object here is not trace preserving. That's why we threw in the denominator. Who can tell me why it's not trace preserving and why that makes sense given the physics of what's happening here? Not even the physics, just the operational, what's going on operationally. Does anyone know? Anyone see it? Remember, these objects aren't describing individual systems. They're describing procedures. That's the key. So when we talk about the state preparation box, it has a go button. And I press that button, individual system comes out, goes into the measurement device. This is the measurement device. And then the light goes off. And then I read a pointer position. And then I want to describe the output state conditioned on this pointer position. Well, suppose that the probability of this outcome nu is 1/3. That means 1/3 of the time this pointer points to the value of nu we're describing here. And then I'm describing the output system via this map. But 2/3 of the time, I get a different pointer outcome. And I'm not describing those situations. So if I'm describing 1,000 preparation procedures, only about 333 of them, up to fluctuations, only one-third of them am I describing via this measure, via this update map, because that's the subset of the ensemble of preparations from the go button which triggered the outcome new. So when the reason why the output state rho new is subnormalized without explicitly adding the normalization, the reason why it's subnormalized when we just think about this numerator here is because we're describing a subset of the times we press the go button. So our probabilities don't add to one because we're throwing away two-thirds of the outcomes. And so if we want to say, well, now I'm only interested in describing future measurements conditioned on this output, then I add in the normalization factor as a bookkeeping, saying now I want my probabilities to add to one conditioned on I got this outcome new. Okay? And then when you take into account that normalization, so these are Krauss operators. This set are essentially Krauss operators that don't sum to identity. They would sum to one-third of identity based on this one-third example. And then if you want to make them, if you want to renormalize them, then you take whatever this probability is, you put the square root of this probability on each of these guys to renorm, or you divide by the square root of the probability, and you define a renormalized set, which then would be Krauss operators for a CPTP map. Okay, so that's kind of, it's just the bookkeeping of how many systems are you describing related to how many times you press the go button on the preparation device. So earlier on in class, I said that we can just think about this one box. We can think about this one box as kind of the do everything box. We can drop the transformation box. And that's exactly because of this. Okay, we can just describe a general transformation now that we have this bookkeeping, that we understand the update rule, we understand how to move this dial to design interactions. If we want a pure unitary transformation, then we just choose U to be equal to V. What, did I use V over there? Choose U to be equal to W tensor identity on A, B. Then this U becomes just a unitary transformation W on the system Hilbert space, and we've described a unitary transformation with no normalization issues. Okay, so this one box, if it's described by this Nymark story, describes everything. The only thing we're missing now that I think about it is we kind of want like a little go button on here. That's the one piece that's missing. So you could probably, I haven't thought about that, so I won't address it now, but I'm assuming we could do that. Okay, and then the one last piece of this, and then I'll open the floor to some questions, is I wanted to talk to you about decoherence. I've already mentioned this, but let me mention it again now that we've seen this a couple of times. In general, if we don't condition on the outcome, so we don't see the pointer, then we don't have to renormalize, because then we're going to sum over all cases. So by ignoring the pointer, the update rule is just rho goes to rho prime equal to a sum over new, sum over, what do I call it? Okay, so this is really, this should be now J sub new. Mj sub nu rho mj sub nu. Okay, so now mj sub nu is the same thing as mj comma nu. That just seems like a cleaner notation. So for each nu, there's going to be some set of indices j. So I'm indexing the index by an index. And then that's what's happening there. So now this is the output state, and this, what is this going to do? If I have a coherent input state, what happens when I sum over the different possibilities?
Decoherent.
Exactly. So this is a decoherence process. So it kills off the quantumness relative to the basis of the measurement. So decoherence process, it's a model for kind of environment. A lot has been said about how that induces classicality, and I think that's completely overrated, overblown. But it's very interesting and very important, certainly in describing real-world systems. Okay, so this one story now describes essentially almost everything we care about. It talks about transformations. You can think about conditioning on some outcome new, some observed outcome as being a preparation procedure. You can think of it as a measurement. You could think of it as includes the collapse rule, includes state update, and it includes decoherence. So essentially, this one story, this one primitive element is all of open system quantum mechanics, is in this equation right here. Okay, I'm happy to take any questions if there are any. Oh, great.
Is there any reason we put the commas in between the indices here? Is there like a specific thing we're trying to emphasize, or is this just...
You mean why I changed notation there?
No, just there in general, why you're writing new comma j.
So the outcome, there's a set of operators associated with the outcome. So first of all, in some cases, there is no sum over j. So if you're doing if these measurements are non-degenerate, then you get no extra sum. And that's often what you see in the few textbooks that have this. So this is the most general form. And so essentially think of nu as being associated with some non-rank one subspace of the Hilbert space. And now the point is different things can happen within that high rank subspace. And that's what this extra index j. We're kind of subdividing it into special cases that correspond to the different ways that different things that can happen within this subspace. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a conceptual answer. I don't know if you're looking for a more mathematical. Well, I didn't really derive this for you guys. I think the derivation is in the notes. So maybe you could review the derivation. It's pretty straightforward. I don't know if there'd be much value in me repeating it, but. Do you guys want me to derive it? How many of you know? You guys are happy to move on to entanglement? All right, so if anyone's interested, have a look at the notes. If something's not clear, just send me an email or ask me later in the week after class or something. But yeah, it's a complete derivation in those notes, so you should be good. Great, so now we'll move on to entanglement. Ask that we cover Bell's theorem, and we'll definitely do that. We probably won't get to Bell's theorem today, but very likely tomorrow. So we'll assume that we have some joint system, some composite system, and then. We'll talk about some state psi AB, which is an element of this composite Hilbert space. In full generality, we can always write psi AB as a sum over JK, alpha JK, AJ, tensor BK, where as usual, AJ is an orthonormal basis for HA, and BK is an orthonormal basis for HB. So it's a pretty self-evident notation. So these are just expansion coefficients, which are determined as usual from the inner product. So any state can be written in this way. So these are scalars. These are just scalars. And then similarly, now we have density operators. So now any density operator, any row, which is a density operator on HA tensor HB, can be expressed in terms of a whole bunch of indices. We'll call them LK, L prime, K prime. Row L, L prime, K, K prime. AL, AL prime, tensor BK, BK prime. And then here, these guys are complex numbers, and they're just the matrix elements. Oh, we'll run it out. So these are matrix elements, so you can do. Now I can just do shorthand L, L prime, row, K, K prime. Okay, so I'm calling this AL, AL prime. I don't need the A anymore. As long as I remember it's in Hilbert space A, I can just call it L, just the label. So I'm working in some basis defined by some operator I care about, like the energy operator or the Z component of angular momentum. Now we saw the definition of for entanglement for a pure state. So we have a pure state is entangled. A pure state is unentangled. Unentangled if and only if there exists alpha in HA and a beta in HB, so some vectors such that the pure state, let's call this phi. And then otherwise, it is called entangled. Okay, and then a state of this form is sometimes called a factor state or a tensor product state. A factorable state or a product state, sorry. And then we have a definition likewise for mixed states. A density operator row on HA tensor HB is called unentangled, or another word for this is separable. If and only if there exists a collection of density operators on system A so and a collection of density operators on system B such that
what I call it, rho. Rho is equal to a sum over I pi rho ai tensor rho bi. Where pi is a probability vector, probability distribution. Okay, so if we can find some collection of density operators on both systems that enable this kind of decomposition for rho, then we call rho unentangled or separable. And otherwise, rho is entangled. Okay, so the spirit of this definition is this. If I have a preparation device, and Maite has a preparation device, and we call her Hilbert space HB, my Hilbert space is HA. If we can create the state rho, which is a joint state, by being separate from each other, and we just have some prescribed plan where we share some common randomness, so we say we have a, say we call each other on the phone and report the results of coin flips to each other. Or we have a pre-existing list of random numbers, and we decide a priori that for each random number on the list, we're either going to prepare state I equals 1, state I equals 2, state I equals 3, where her states can be anything she wants, my states can be anything I want, but we have to index them in an ordered way. So I have some collection of states which are indexed, 1 through whatever, and so does Maite. And then we have some source of randomness which is shared, either through communication or through a pre-existing list of random numbers. And we have a plan based on those random numbers to create a system prepared by this procedure indexed by something that depends on that random number. So in other words, we don't need to share any quantum resources together. We only need our own personal quantum resources to create this state. And then we can each send those states to a third party, say Neil. So we do this procedure, system one, we look at the random number, each of us prepares, system one is system A, the first time you press the go button. So here now, think about, we each press our go button on our preparation device, but we have a dial. The setting of the dial depends on the random number, which picks out a preparation procedure. So she has a preparation procedure, I have a preparation procedure, depends on this random number. We both press our go button, we both send the first instance of our preparation procedure to, say, Neil, and then Neil gets both copies of both physical systems, and now he wants to describe his quantum state. Now, if we followed those rules, then that means that once we reveal our recipes to Neil, he can write down this state to describe this collection of systems we send him, the copies of the same, of this protocol, instances of the protocol from each time you press the go button. Okay, so that's the spirit. The point is that this state can be prepared in a space-like separated way. Now, there are preparation procedures there are density operators in the Hilbert space which cannot be prepared via such a procedure, and those are called entangled states. Those require, basically, the spirit of it is this. Does the preparation procedure require some unitary coupling between the two Hilbert spaces? Okay, so compare a procedure where Alice and Bob both prepare states. Alice applies her own map. Bob applies his own map. Where you can even, let's make it simple, let's just call this some unitary. So these guys are separated by a barrier of some sort. Then we have some joint state, which then corresponds to a unentangled state. If, however, we have Alice preparing, Bob preparing, and they're near each other, or they give it to someone who can then take the two systems
and apply some unitary where U is not of the form UA tensor UB. Then rho can be entangled. Okay, so what's an example of this? Let's take it all the way back to undergrad physics to make this clear. So for example, consider two unitaries. Consider U equal to an exponential e to the minus I sigma x for system A, tensor sigma y for system B, plus, that's good. So what's this doing? This is a coupling interaction due to, say, a dipole-dipole coupling between two spin-half particles. So this is not expressible in this form. Okay, so this is not equal to UA tensor UB. Okay, what would be equal to UA tensor UB would be U, if U is equal to this, e to the minus I sigma XA tensor identity with some, you know, coefficient omega. Plus some other coefficient, which can be the same. Omega A and omega B can be the same. Identity tensor sigma XB. This is equal to UA tensor UB. So here we have a physical interaction between the systems. Here we're just saying the physics of this situation is this. System A sees a magnetic field that's rotating around the x-axis. System B, which is in the second Hilbert space, sees a magnetic field which is rotating about its x-axis. The fact that this can be x or y or z, it doesn't matter. The important thing is that the structure of the operators in the argument of the exponential, so this is the Hamiltonian of the system. The Hamiltonian of the system corresponds to local physics for system A, local physics for system B. In this case, the physics is not local physics for each one. It's an interaction between the two. So you can have like a Coulomb interaction, a dipole interaction, whatever the physical forces at play are. If the two systems are kind of feeling each other through a direct interaction, then that corresponds to a coupling that can generate entanglement. So notice in the story with Maite and I, that's a story where we both have Hamiltonians of this form and we're sending our systems off to a third party. That means we've generated the state via an interaction of this form, so we'll never be able to take a factor state and create entanglement. But if we were in the same room and we had had our physical systems near enough each other, because, you know, physics depends on distance typically, then we're able to prepare some coupling between the systems, which would create entanglement between them. Okay, so now by looking at density operators, we're allowing for everything to be noisy and imperfect, and for things to be coupled to other systems we're ignoring. So this gives us a very, very general description. And just for clarity, the argument I gave at the beginning of class about how the completely positive map picture is not adequate to describe all physics, that's not true for density operators. Density operators are robust. Okay, so we're not going to, there's no problems with taking density operators as a postulate that I know of. There's only a problem for taking POVMs and CP maps as postulates. The notion of density operators is a very robust concept. So don't be worried about using this as a fundamental starting point. You can always use pure states as a fundamental starting point, but there's no risk in using mixed states for this case. So that's the mathematical definition. This is the conceptual distinction about whether or not you can generate states that break this mold. So to generate states that break this mold, this mathematical model, to generate an arbitrary state in the joint Hilbert space, we are going to need a procedure which includes elements like this. In fact, for two spins, it's sufficient to have one coupling of this form, combined with local interactions, you can generate any element of SU4, which is the set of all unitaries on two-level systems. Okay, so now let me just ask some questions because this is new for a lot of you. Yeah.
You say there that the row can be entangled. Does that mean it's always entangled, or there's
no? It's not always entangled. It turns out you can choose here. This should have some coupling constant here. That coupling constant will depend on the physical interaction, and it will depend on the time under which the Hamiltonian evolved. So that all gets compiled into this one parameter. You can choose values of this parameter where this unitary becomes identity. So in sense you entangle them and then you unentangle them, and they leave your device unentangled even though they were momentarily entangled inside. So obviously trivially you said gamma equals zero, but non-trivially you said gamma equal like 2 pi or 4 pi or something like that. This becomes identity. And so that's why it can be entangled. In other words, this interaction is necessary to generate entanglement, but won't always generate entanglement. It'll also depend on the input states. If my input states, suppose this is X and this is Y. That's the coupling interaction. Pick any value of gamma you want. Let the input state to this unitary be an eigenstate of sigma X on A and an eigenstate of sigma Y on B. That product state, which is an unentangled input state, is an eigenstate of this, which means that this has no effect on that state. It'll have effects on other states. It'll entangle other states, but there's a set of measure zero states which this won't entangle. So that's why we have can be here. Thank you. That was a great question. Any others? OK, so now we actually get to some really interesting physics, and we'll lead up to this open problem of how do we check. If I give you a density operator in mathematical form, so some 4x4 matrix, say, for two spin halves, or if it's two three-level systems, it's a 9x9 matrix, and I say, tell me, is this entangled or not? Does there exist such a decomposition? Well, obviously, there's a continuously infinite set of different decompositions you have to explore. There's a continuously infinite set of choices of basis where you'd want to check if one of them gave you this structure. And that's not going to happen, right? That's just, it's a continuous infinity. So you need some cleverness to figure out how can I check if the state, if a general state, which is just some matrix, this is the matrix, if I can find some family of density operators on A and B and some probability distribution, which is going to give me this structure, which means it's unentangled. Okay, so how do you do that? And it turns out that problem is solved for two spin half particles, for one spin half particle and one spin one particle, and for one spin half particle and an infinite dimensional system, we have a complete answer. But for all other dimensions, it's an open problem. So before we get to that, let me tell you a little bit about entropy, which is an important. So we saw that this Schmidt rank and the Schmidt decomposition was one way to test for entanglement of pure states. But to look at entanglement for mixed states, we're going to want to think about things like entropy, which is a more robust characterization of entanglement anyways. There's a question?
Yeah, sorry, just about when you said that there is an answer for like several or some cases of Hilbert spaces, do you mean there's an analytic answer or?
Yeah, there's a computational procedure that allows you to determine that gives a necessary and sufficient condition to test for whether the input state was entangled. And it's based on, well, just as a foreshadowing, it's based on the distinction between positive and completely positive maps that we saw earlier. So the value of studying that wasn't just background. It also ends up being a practical tool in the theory of entanglement. So now recall, if we are promised that row, let's call it row AB. So row AB refers to the density operator for system AB. If we're promised that row AB is a pure state, or if we can check it, we don't have to be promised, or we check, we confirm by computation . Okay, this is the check for purity. So someone gives you that matrix and they say, is this entangled? First thing you do, determine if it's pure. Calculate trace rule squared, is it equal to 1? If yes, then it's pure. Okay, then rho A equal to the trace over B of rho AB is pure if and only if rho AB is unentangled. Okay, so for pure states, we know the solution already. We can always check for entanglement because we have a necessary and sufficient condition if we're promised or if we checked that rho AB is pure. And it's likewise for rho B. The problem is symmetric, okay? So I could have put rho B here and made that an A. Because rho A is pure if and only if rho B is pure. Okay, and so it's kind of obvious because so the proof is simple. If psi AB is unentangled, then there exists some alpha tensor beta. So there's some, you can write it in a basis such that that's true. That's the definition of it's unentangled. Then there exists this decomposition. So let's just compute the partial trace. So then the trace over B of psi AB, just equal to the trace over B of alpha alpha tensor beta beta. So now you evaluate the trace over B is just a full trace here, which just gives 1. So this is equal to alpha alpha, which is pure. Okay, so you can see why this has to be true. So for pure states, we can go beyond talking about is it entangled or not. We can talk about how much entanglement does it have. Okay, so now there's an operational meaning for that, which I'll maybe not get into, of what you mean by entanglement, which is basically your ability to convert, take a bunch of sub-maximally entangled states and create a smaller number of copies of the systems which are in maximally entangled states. So that's called entanglement distillation. So there's an operational notion of how much entanglement you have in some preparation procedure. But the natural measure based on these operational criteria, the natural metric, I don't know if it's a metric, I'll call it a measure. It's not a quantification. is the von Neumann entropy? So the von Neumann entropy of the reduced state tells you about the entanglement of the state on the full Hilbert space. So this is defined as minus the trace of rho A log rho A. And conventionally, it's the log base 2 by convention. Now, rho is an operator. What is the log of an operator? This is a pop quiz question. How do you calculate the log of an operator?
It's the sum of like the eigenvalues times log of the eigenvalues.
Yeah, you do a spectral decomposition of the operator, which means you diagonalize it, and you act the function on its eigenvalues. Okay, so in general, for any function of an operator, that's the definition. So recall some function f of an operator A is equal to, or in fact is defined as, sum over A, that function applied to AI. Where the spectral decomposition of A, as usual, is this form. Okay, so we do the same with the log. Now, what's the problem with the log? What happens if we do this spectral decomposition and it's for a density operator? And suppose the density operator is in a three-dimensional Hilbert space, but it has two eigenvalues that are non-zero and one zero eigenvalue, because it's only a density operator on a rank 2 subspace of the three-level system. Then one of the eigenvalues is zero. And what's the log of zero? Minus infinity. What's zero times minus infinity? It turns out it's zero. Okay. So by definition, we impose that zero log zero is equal to zero. Okay. So why do we want to do that? Because suppose I have a pure state. Suppose rho A is a pure state. And I want to calculate S of alpha, that's going to be equal to minus I times the trace. So forget about the trace, but we're going to have, write it as a trace. We're going to have essentially 0 times the log of 0. So then we just define that. We demand that that's zero. Okay, because what we want to say, remember what entropy means. Entropy measure, when entropy increases, it means you know less. Entropy is a measure of uncertainty or disorder. It's lack of knowledge. Okay, so what you want is for pure states, you have maximal knowledge about the preparation. You can't have a better description of a preparation procedure than a pure state. It's the best description. Okay, so that means you want the entropy of a pure state to be zero, and then you want the entropy to increase as you have less and less information about the procedure. So maximum knowledge, which if we listen to Einstein is not complete knowledge, maximum for quantum mechanics, maximum knowledge we want, which corresponds to a pure state, we want the entropy to be equal to zero, which means we have no lack of knowledge. And for maximum uncertainty, That corresponds to an identity state. Okay. The identity state, this means that we want, geez, it's really hard to write with good handwriting at the bottom of the board. You want S of identity over D to be at its maximum possible value, which is going to be, if I remember correctly, D. Or maybe log D, log D. So entropy is measured on a log scale. The identity state is the unique state that gives maximum entropy. And the set of all pure states is the set of all states that give minimum entropy. So in general, we have that S of rho is bound between log D and zero, or any rho as a density operator. A density operator, same mistake. The density operator on a d-dimensional Hilbert space. And then other properties of the entropy is concavity. So S of sum over I pi rho I is less than or equal, or is greater than or equal to the sum over I pi S rho I. And if rho AB is pure, then S of rho A is equal to S of rho B. So if you have a joint pure state, then the entropy of the reduced state on either side of the Hilbert space is the same. So the idea here, based all on this assumption that we have a global pure state, the state is globally pure, which corresponds to maximal knowledge about the joint system. The only way you can get non-zero entropy is if the state is entangled. And the more entangled it is, the more uncertain you are about your description of the individual system. So you have this trade-off in quantum mechanics, which is a bit like the uncertainty principle. I can have, if I have maximum knowledge about the joint properties of the system, which I know everything about their entanglement, then I know nothing about the individual systems. And if I have full knowledge of each individual system independently, then they have no entanglement. So this is trade-off. That was a little bit hand-wavy, so that's not a rigorous thing. Let me just say as a final note before we end that the entropy is a useful quantification of the amount of entanglement for entanglement distillation and what's the other one? Entanglement distillation and, well, I'll just say entanglement distillation. Entanglement of distillation and formation. Okay, so basically the idea is that I have a box that prepares entangled states. It spits out system, joint systems. And then the question is, you say, well, let's count the number of times I press the go button as a resource. Okay, so it costs money. I bought the box and they charge me 10 cents every time I press the button. All right, so then I can buy two boxes. One box has a certain price per pressing the button, and it produces some joint state rho AB, and it's, you know, say it's 10 cents per copy. And I have another box that produces state sigma AB, and maybe it's 20 cents per copy per system I create. So each time I create these systems, and they're all prepared according, this is a description of the preparation procedure, and then there's a number of copies I get. And now my goal is to use this entanglement for some task, the entanglement. So I want to say, well, what's the better deal? Because the guy that makes the sigma AB box says, well, I create really close to perfectly entangled states. And the person that creates the rho AB box says, well, they're not as good as the other person's box, but they're still pretty good. But anyways, it's half price. So which one do you buy? Okay, so that's this operational notion of how much entanglement do you have. So it turns out there are protocols where if I have 1,000 copies of some mixed state, I can create, there's a certain procedure I can apply to create fewer copies of perfectly entangled states. So I distill the lousy entanglement into a smaller number of copies with perfect entanglement. And so it turns out that the entropy gives you an exact quantification of how efficient that distillation process is. So what I would do is I would want to know, I'd ask the manufacturer, what's your entropy of entanglement for this? And what's your entropy of entanglement for this box? And then based on knowledge of those numbers, I can figure out the best deal. So that's the idea. So entropy is rigorously proven to be the right characterization of how much entanglement you have based on this idea of it as a resource where the number of copies has a price. So in more realistically in the lab, maybe it takes, you know, 10 milliseconds to create states like this, and it takes 20 milliseconds to create states like this, and I want to create a whole bunch of entangled states so I can go do some experiment. Which one should I use? Well, if I know the entropy, I know which experimental setup is more efficient and allows me to do the experiment faster to get that same number of copies. Any questions about this? Yes?
She asked before if the state, the density matrix at the end of going through the unitary time evolution was necessarily entangled, and you said no because you could set the parameters so that you could undo the entanglement. But I'm wondering, is entanglement always a reversible process? Like we know we can measure it, but is there different types of entanglement? Because mm-hmm. the unitaries we've been looking at, the C0 gate and polymer gate, they're both, they square to 1, so they're equal to their own inverses. But if we add another gate such that we can get sequences of matrices that have determinant 0, for instance, is it possible to create entanglement that's not, you can't cool back down? Unentangle it.
It depends what a unitary is you allow yourself. If you allow yourself any unitary on the joint Hilbert space, then yes, you can undo anything because quantum mechanics is reversible. But that's an interesting research question that comes up in the context of I put some restriction on what unitaries I can do. And I ask about equivalence classes of entanglement. So it turns out that there are, if you're only allowed to do what are called local operations.
Well, one and two side. Or what do you mean by local?
Local operations means that I'm restricted to operations of the form. It's now missing. If I only have local operations available, you can ask, can I take any entangled state and convert it into a different entangled state with the same amount of entropy? Maybe that's related to what you're asking. I'm just throwing that out there that it turns out that that's not always true. You can't interconvert different entangled states. Can you always take them back to identity? I don't know. If you allow any unitary, then yes. If you restrict the unitaries, then it's I don't know the answer. But for general unitaries, yeah. If you say, look, I can do anything I want to the system, then the linear algebra tells you I can rotate Yeah, well, CP maps are irreversible in general. So generally, you can't undo things. CP maps are, entropy is monotonically increasing under, or non-decreasing under CP maps that aren't unitary. I have to think about that more carefully before I answer. But it turns out those are all very good research questions, and people actually spend a lot of time trying to understand the hierarchical structures depending on these different questions. Yeah?
I was just going to ask, like, what type of restrictions would you have on the unitaries? Are they just, like, physical restrictions of what can actually be realized, or why would
well,
we improve?
In practice, people tend to only worry about, look, entanglement is really kind of only interesting in this notion where you have space-like separation. So if everybody's always in the same room using the same apparatus, then entanglement really isn't that interesting. It's really only interesting when you talk about it as a resource for people who are separated. So what we're going to see with Bell's theorem and with these non-local games is that if you and I have access to some shared entangled states, we can outperform other people at certain tasks if they only have unentangled states. So the restrictions you typically look at are whether or not you have unitaries that can couple or not. So it's this distinction right here. That's called the LOCC distinction. Am I limited to local operations and classical communication or versus global quantum transformations? So global quantum transformations means I have a scenario where I can do anything, I can interact the systems in an arbitrary way, and local operations means I can only do my own local transformations, and I can communicate to someone classically, but I can't physically interact the two systems to create a quantum interaction. So that's the practical distinction. There's probably other subtle areas, other subtle considerations, but off the top of my head, I can't think of any. Any other questions? Yeah?
Yeah, sorry, just continuing on that. Okay, so in theory, you can go back, but I'm just wondering if you give me a density matrix, like two different density matrices, and they have the same sort of amount of entangling entropy, but they have different level statistics, and that one is sort of Poisson statistics localized, the other one has random matrix statistics, so it's thermal since you brought in entropy. Is there just a way that you can know whether you can go backwards and disentangle the states? Like, I'm just wondering if you have two different density matrices, can you always find a solution to go back? Like, in theory, you say, okay, yeah, sure, unitary, you can just have an inverse, but.
Well, okay, first of all, so level statistics is normally something that describes the Hamiltonian, not the state.
Sure.
So I'm not sure what you mean there, but given any two density operators, when you say given two density operators, do you mean that they're the reduced density operators associated with them joint entangled state, or just that are they of this form?
Or a full system density operator versus reduced?
When you say given two density operators, I'm not sure if you have in mind.
I mean, basically, this guy that came out of the cryos up there. That's kind of.
Out of this entangling interaction. So that's one density operator of the joint system.
And then you.
But then you look at the reduced states, and then you want to ask about acting on those reduce states to return back to some original state.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, again, if you have access to the interaction box again, then you can do anything. If you don't have access to an interaction box and you only have local boxes for each one, then you can't. Because you can decrease the amount of entanglement, but you can't increase the amount of entanglement if you're only acting locally on each system. That's the LOCC principle. Okay, so next class we'll do Bell's theorem on non-local games. You can see a concrete example of how entanglement is actually not just this mysterious thing, but a concrete resource for tasks. Thanks for your questions.